Hello and welcome to this episode of Invest Africa Insights. Today we're talking about something that really is the backbone of economic development, infrastructure. Estimates of Africa's infrastructure gap fall consistently somewhere between $70 billion and $107 billion, and pressure on the continent's existing infrastructure will only increase as the population grows and urbanisation progresses. Closing the infrastructure funding gap will be crucial to Africa's long-term sustainable growth, and on a more positive note, there is capital available in the market that is often not leveraged effectively in African infrastructure projects. Today, I'm joined by the perfect person to help us understand why this funding gap is so persistent and what needs to be done to begin to close it. Philippe Valahou is CEO of the Private Infrastructure Development Group. Philippe, welcome to the show. It's great to have you on.
Very happy to be here. Thank you.
So it's really great to have you on today because PIDGE works really across the financing and project development spectrum. So you're very well placed to explain to us where the blockages are in the system and also what the solutions might be. So perhaps if we could start there. Why do you think the funding gap has been so persistent in African infrastructure?
Thank you. I think you said it very nicely in your introductory remarks. You made a point which resonates with me and is a point that I make at every forum that I participate in, because I think it's a critical one. And the point that you made was there is financing out there. The issue is really not the availability of capital. Whether it comes from the pension funds or whether it comes from financial institutions, other financial institutions, it is there. And we spend quite a lot of time talking about that capital and how you deploy it, but we spend less amount of time talking about what for me is the critical piece, and that's in order to attract that financing, you have to have a pipeline of bankable transactions. You have to have a pipeline of transactions that have been de-risked if we have any hope of attracting the pension funds in a scalable and meaningful way. And so we spend a lot of time on that downstream funding piece. We don't spend enough time on the upstream, which is less glamorous, but it's the early stage project development. And when you think about it, a typical $100 million infrastructure project, you're looking at 5 to 10% development capital. So that is the cost to develop that asset, take it to successful financial close. So you're talking $5, $10 million. So the sums are not that extravagant, but there isn't enough going into that specific space. And therefore, if you don't have that pipeline of bankable transactions, you're not going to make much of a dent in attracting the financing that could otherwise be available. And you're not going to make a dent in that gap that you're talking about, the 70 to 100 billion a year in sub-Saharan Africa.
Yeah, and it's interesting now that you mentioned de-risking projects, because that's sort of at the core of what you do. So perhaps it might be helpful if you could explain just a little bit about what the PIDGE organizations do to help that early stage funding, to help that de-risking.
Yes, I think that's an important piece. And risk, again, is one of those areas where we all get rather frustrated. I'm sure you've been to events where you're sitting on a panel and somebody will in the audience ask you to comment about risk in Africa. And it's an amusing question when you think about it, because how do you begin to compare risk in a country in Southern Africa, Eastern Africa, Central Africa? There are different pockets of different types of risk, as there are in any other region of the world. So with that as a background, one of the things that we do, so if you look at the early stage project development, and I could cite numerous examples where we've worked in, I don't know, Uganda, Tanzania, Rwanda, Mozambique, Cote d'Ivoire, Senegal, Liberia. Very often, these are projects that make all the sense in the world. But people are concerned with the risk. They can be government, political risk, regulatory risk. And so what we do is by taking that risk and putting the risk capital to work, and again, we're talking about that 5 to 10%, we can take that risk because we have the ability to take a long-term view. And so we will deploy that cash to develop an asset, take it to financial close, and then look to exit, having pretty much de-risked the project. Now, if we're unable to attract investment, private investment at financial close, we can stay through construction and wait for construction to be completed, by which time or you've got the project further de-risked. And in the worst case, if there is still a perception of risk, we will stay past end of construction for a year or two. But again, our primary objective is to be able to exit as soon as possible, as soon as the market thinks we have de-risked it sufficiently to attract private investors who otherwise might not come into that particular country and in that subsector. So that's one aspect of the puzzle for our group, and that's the early stage project development. But I wouldn't want to neglect the other piece, which we also have a funding arm through our debt fund and a guarantee arm that provides local currency solutions. And again, those are also part of the solution in terms of providing the de-risking to attract. So when we're working on guarantees in Togo, for example, helping local banks extend the tenors beyond the 3 to 5 years that they would only be able to do because of local regulations and taking them out to 10 years, again, that's a way for us to help, in that case, domestic bank de-risk the project and allow them to go forward. And we've seen in some projects on the guarantee side how powerful an instrument it's been. We've worked with local banks, for example, who initially came for the first project and wanted 100% guarantee. Fine. So that was put in place. Then they come back for the second project, having fully understood or better understood how the guarantee mechanism worked and what the potential risk is and the potential losses. So in the second time around, they'll say, actually, we only require 50% guarantee. And then the third time around, they might go either without a guarantee or a 10, 20% guarantee. And so for us, the success there is that you're not only generating infrastructure projects, you're developing local capital markets, and you're providing the capacity building to these financial institutions who would otherwise not have been able to understand or take the risk before that.
It's interesting there that you mentioned local currency, and perhaps we could just delve a little bit deeper into that. How big of an issue do you think currency risk is in preventing more international players, more pension funds coming into African markets?
It is a big issue, but one of the things that we do through our guarantee arm, it really has two mandates when you think about it. Yes, it's like the rest of the group, development of infrastructure, providing access to infrastructure in the countries that we work, but it's also the dual mandate of local capital markets development. So in a country like Nigeria, we set up a entity locally working with the Nigerian Sovereign Investment Authority to provide guarantees denominated or to backstop, if you will, Naira-denominated bond issuance for local infrastructure projects, which means then these are taken up by domestic pension funds and domestic insurance companies who, prior to us putting this in place 2.5 years ago, had never invested in the infrastructure asset class. And in fact, the regulatory framework didn't allow for it. So working with the regulatory authorities, that was changed, allowing pension funds and insurance companies in that market to be able to invest in the infrastructure asset class. Now, in Nigeria, that pool of money is probably between $20-30 billion, a fraction of what it might be in South Africa, for example. But if you take Nigeria and other countries where we are considering this, these pretty interesting pockets of capital that are otherwise not being used in the way that they should be, and in a way that they're used in countries like North America or Europe. And so that's an area we're spending, I must say, quite a lot of resources and trying to work with partners to be able to explain and to show why this is a critical piece of the puzzle.
And a slightly more difficult question for you. Do you feel that at the moment, DFIs and sort of institutions like yourself, which sort of sit in a sort of multilateral development bank position, are doing enough to de-risk the market for private capital? Is there more that you can do? What's the sort of big innovations that you think would accelerate this?
I think there's considerably more we can and we should do. I participated a couple of weeks ago at a PPP conference event held by one of the MDBs, and there were 370 participants. And it was a fascinating conversation for 5 hours, but listening to the themes on the upstream capacity building, working with the government, supporting the government, setting up PPP units, working down the project cycle to early stage project development and then funding solutions. One can only get frustrated at times when you think about the fact that we've been having these discussions for quite a long time. And so, yes, there is a clear role for the DFIs and MDBs to play. When you look at the number of commercial banks today able to put or deploy 15, 20-year money, you can count them on one hand. So there is a role to play, but that role has got to also be about, and I think that's what the banks are asking for and continuously asking for, finding a ways to bring them in. And we go back to the issue of de-risking. Because at the end of the day, we're not here to substitute ourselves. We should be finding a way to put ourselves out of business. In fact, one of the things I tell staff when we recruit somebody, welcome to pitch, your job is to put yourself out of business as soon as possible. Now, I know that's not going to happen in 10 years. I know that's not going to happen in 15 years. But I think that's the mindset that we go into this, because we have to be able to bring in the private sector to do these things. What's missing is clearly a total lack of coordination. And I, no critique, because I have worked for an MDB in my past career when I worked in the public sector before going back to banking. So I have worked there. But you see well-meaning MDBs in different regions or some of the global ones overstepping on each other's toes and trying to do the same thing. And, you know, the setting up PPPs, for example, in sub-Saharan Africa, count the number of players, DFIs or MDBs, that are trying to do this. How do you provide more a framework and an incentive for greater cooperation? And for me, that's something that in my career yet, I don't think I've seen unlocked, but something I fight for every day.
And do you feel that sort of greater cooperation is something that needs to be led on a sort of on a national level, international institution level, by the private sector, by governments? Where do you think the sort of leadership needs to come from?
It's an interesting one. I attended a conference in West Africa a couple of years ago, and a minister from an African country in the audience looked at the panel, and the panel was staffed by people from MDBs. And he looked at them and said, what we need is a new MDB. And everybody in the crowd frowned. And then he said, hold on, let me make my point. And he said, I, as a minister who is able to benefit from the various tools and products that you MDBs have in your toolkit and continuously come up with, I need an MDB to help me navigate through these things, because sometimes the same product is offered in 10 institutions and I can't make heads or tails of it. He made a powerful point, which resonated with me and resonated with, I think, practically the whole audience. So I know that we'll probably come on to this after, but blended finance. So everybody's talking about blended finance. And the OECD is doing quite a lot of work. Convergence are doing quite a lot of work on getting the principles and getting agreement on what constitutes blended finance. But all of a sudden, there's a rush to do what people think is blended finance. And there's a risk that there's a rush to the bottom, because blended finance, we should have some agreed terms and conditions of what it is and what it is not. So even there, there's a strong attempt by a number of institutions, including the ones I've just mentioned, who are trying to provide greater coordination and leadership. But leadership can come from different sectors, I think, or different institutions.
It's interesting there that you mentioned blended finance, well, because, you know, it's always brought up as sort of the funding solution for African infrastructure, but you know, actually across the spectrum in the region. So perhaps you can just elaborate a little bit more on what that means and whether you think blended finance is the best way forward.
It's interesting. And I think I would point to the work that Convergence have been doing on this. I think they're doing some very, very interesting work. And in fact, when I think of entities that are being thought leaders on the issue of blended finance, they are one of the first ones that come to mind. One of the things I always say when we talk about this is we have to make sure that we're not doing two things if we're trying to put in blended finance instruments. One, that it doesn't become a tool to prop up returns for the investor, because I think that is not the purpose of the blended finance instrument. And two, that we don't end up putting in place concession finance for governments that should otherwise be seeking it elsewhere. At Private Infrastructure Development Group, for example, we have various products that we deploy under the heading of blended finance. But imagine a country where a power purchase agreement has been negotiated, hypothetically, say, 10 cents. And then the government decides pretty much unilaterally that it might think that is a bit high and would like to see that come down to 6. Now, if you're the investor, you might come to PIDGE and say, can we put some viability gap funding to make up the differential? Is that the right use of our tool? Probably not, because effectively, we might be helping the project there, but effectively we're providing subsidized lending to the government in question to allow that deal to happen. So I think we need to be very careful. And for me, a good example that always comes to mind, we worked on this with a number of players, including the African Development Bank on the debt side. But this was the development of the Kigali water project in Rwanda, and the concessionaire is Metito out of the Middle East. And again, there you've got some traditional lending. So you've got 18-year lending from our own debt fund, African Development Bank, on commercial terms. But also at financial close, we put in a $5 or $6 million viability gap funding instrument, which was used to be able to ensure that connections to the water would be made available to those in Kigali who would not otherwise be able to afford it. And if you'd included that in the model, then it made it less attractive and more difficult for a private sector to come in and do it. By having that piece that effectively plugs the gap for that segment of society that cannot afford it, then you've got, a very good use of blended financing. And you're trying, again, to put the minimum amount required to be able to attract 18-year money from both the African Development Bank and ourselves. And the debt, I think, on that project is $32 or $34 million.
Philippe, it wouldn't be, we can't not discuss coronavirus, I'm afraid. So just wondering, just interested to hear from you how the pandemic's impacted your work. How it's impacted the projects you're working on? Have you had to delay or stop, or are you back up and running most of the places now?
It's been quite challenging. When you think about it, our teams based in, whether they're based in London, whether they're based in Morocco, because we're opening an office in Casablanca, or based in Nairobi, or based in Singapore, the inability to travel to see existing clients for due diligence purposes, that is slowing the progress of some of the transactions. And that is forcing us, as I'm sure others, to rethink the whole idea of due diligence, how you carry out your due diligence. Because we can be hopeful and say COVID will be over by December 31, but you know, we've been saying every 2 months the same thing, it'll be over in 2 months, and there is no end in sight yet. So we have to adapt. So what has been the most surprising for me over the past 6 months is how resilient, in fact, the teams within Page, and I see it elsewhere as well, have been, and how much progress we've actually been able to do on a lot of transactions absent being able to go in country. But you reach a point at some point where you need that final meeting with a Ministry of Energy or a Ministry of Land to iron out the final issues that have come up in agreements. You need to go kick the tires on the ground, and that is simply not possible right now. So it is causing a slight slowdown. If I look at our 2020 results and where we are today, where we expect to be, I'm frankly amazed. Because if you had told me in March when this broke out that we would be as advanced as we are today on some of the transactions, I would have thought that was a bit optimistic. But in fact, we've been able to progress quite a lot. But again, it really depends how much longer this goes on.
And do you see there being a long-term impact from this crisis? Or are you of the sort of school of thought that thinks that actually in a sort of silver lining approach, there might be a sort of kick into action as a result of the disruption that could be a big driving force?
Well, I think the latter. I'm a born optimist, and I have to believe that there's a this provides the kick in the backside that we all need to just get on with it and accelerate things. And indeed, if you speak to the industry and a number of fora that are currently addressing these very points, the sense of urgency, if there was one a year ago, and there was, the sense of urgency today has tripled, I think. And I think what it will do, including for ourselves, is focus the mind. So at Page, we cover infrastructure, and infrastructure has a very broad definition because it includes sectors like agribusiness, where you have infrastructure components. It can include, in some cases, manufacturing, where you have the infrastructure components, power, water, etc. And social infrastructure, which for us include affordable housing, health sector, and education. So I think for us, and as we're nearing the end of the year, as you can imagine, we're in business planning mode. One of the things we're absolutely looking at is what you're talking about, then, that is, what does this mean for us going forward? How does that affect our ongoing and current strategy? And I think we're all pretty clear on this, and with the board, that there's got to be a focus and do what we do very well. So if you look at our early stage project development companies, both in sub-Saharan Africa and Asia, one of the key areas for them and probably 50% of the portfolio is renewable energy. That clearly will continue to be a high priority because electricity is not just for the villages, remote villages where we're able to provide the power, but it's power for hospital, power for clinics, which in this COVID world and post-COVID world becomes ever more critical. So I think a sharpening and a focusing of the mind for institutions like us, for sure.
And speaking of a focusing of the mind, obviously the African Continental Free Trade Agreement has been, you know, on everyone's mind for quite a few years now, and COVID has disrupted that. But the infrastructure challenge is, you know, is also a fundamental trade challenge. So I was wondering if you could just talk a bit about your view of whether it's possible for the infrastructure to be ready to really allow the African Continental Free Trade Agreement to do what it promises to do.
Again, the optimism tells me yes, the realist probably says it'll take a bit longer. But again, with that particular agreement that you talk about, it can only focus the mind. So when we are looking at some transactions, and not just us, but other entities in transportation, inevitably you have a cross-border element. We're looking at some transactions in the south, in southern Africa, power pool related. And again, you've got cross-border implications. And I think a lot of these transactions, not many yet, because they can be quite complex. They can require a huge amount of resources, and PIDGE has finite resources. But I think I am seeing a much greater interest in those regional solutions. So in Francophone Africa, we're certainly seeing them in that corridor, Uganda, Kenya, Tanzania. Certainly we're seeing them further south and south and southwest Africa. We're seeing it as well. So for me, the answer would be yes. And I think you've got institutions now like PIDGE who are having discussions with entities like Trademark East Africa, which is another, or a UK-funded entity amongst others. If you think about it, Trademark East Africa, I'm not sure that 3-4 years ago, we would have thought, and they would have thought natural for us to be talking to each other. But I think today it's a no-brainer. When you talk, when you speak to Trademark East Africa and some of the things they're looking at, by definition, it's trade, it's logistics, and it's cross-border. And it involves infrastructure, whether it's railway lines, whether it's electricity to power, whether it's development of port infrastructure. So I think, hopefully, I'm seeing a greater meeting of the minds than I've seen before.
That's just my last couple of questions for you. I wanted to just talk a little bit more about some of the projects that PIDGE has worked on. Obviously, power gets a lot of attention in this space, but there are also, you know, deficits in a lot of social infrastructure. And I know you do work there. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about some more about that social infrastructure and whether you think it's getting enough attention, you know, as important as obviously the larger scale projects are.
I think, and I am quite pleased to see it. I think 2 years ago or 2.5 years ago, we embarked on a new 5-year strategy. And one of the things we said we would set out to do is focus a little more, or considerably more, on the social infrastructure bit, but equally within that on areas like affordable housing. And at the time, if you look at the market, it's quite fragmented. 2 years later, and especially in this COVID situation that we find ourselves in, there's a huge amount of interest. Earlier this year, we, for example, and this is an example of projects you're talking about outside of the power sector. We helped launch a student accommodation project in Kenya by providing credit enhancement on a domestic bond issuance to finance those works. And this is the first green bond in Kenya or East Africa, dual listing on the London Stock Exchange, so quite exciting. And this is something we had never done before with our guarantee arm, Garenco. And on the back of that, we're now working with other parts of the group with those same investors. And in the affordable housing space, One of our entities within the group had begun to do some work in that space 3 years ago. And now through that experience, through those lessons learned, and through partners on the ground, and there are quite a few very, very good partners, we're starting to be able to attack or deal with affordable housing in a way that we have never been able to do. And what is comforting for me, I suppose, is seeing not just official entities, so by that I mean government-backed entities, be they based in sub-Saharan Africa or in the UK or other countries, you're also seeing private sector interests, whether domestic or cross-border, realizing that affordable housing can also be a very interesting proposition, whilst at the same time providing critical lodging for people who currently don't have it. So we're doing quite a lot there. I think the bigger challenge is the health sector and what we can or cannot do there. You see, in other regions of the world, the health sector PPP framework is established in countries further north. We've seen some very successful examples and deployment of tools to attract private investment in hospital PPPs. I think it's a little more complicated in the context of sub-Saharan Africa. And so that's, I think, an area that will still need a bit of work. But certainly the other two components of social infrastructure, whether it's affordable housing or student accommodation, are getting off the ground in a very interesting way.
So usually to finish off the show, I ask guests to talk about the opportunities they're most excited about and the markets they're moving into. But perhaps with you, it would be more appropriate to ask if there are any markets that you are hopeful of being able to leave, that you are hopeful of being able to put yourself out of business in.
Uh-huh, that's a very good question. Well, effectively, when you think about it and when you look at the entity we set up in Nigeria, so this is through Guarantco, and we hope to provide additional support to that entity in Nigeria shortly before the end of this year. When you think about that, the setting it up effectively meant that Guarantco was, for all intents and purposes, pulling out of that country and replacing it or replacing ourselves with a domestic financial institution to do the same thing we were doing before, but domestically. And with the understanding that in the event there is a project that requires greater capacity than the local entity is able to provide, we might be able to come in and co-guarantee alongside the entity we helped set up. So I think that is a very good example. And we hope to be able to continue to deploy these infra credits throughout sub-Saharan Africa. We have been looking at a couple of countries in Eastern Africa. We're looking at the French-speaking zone, obviously, in West Africa. There's a strong logic for having one there. And again, the idea by setting it up would be to allow us then to, from a guarantee perspective, to be able to exit those countries because we would have put in place a domestic entity that can do the same thing. If I look more broadly at sectors, that is a more difficult piece or products. So, for example, if I look at our debt fund providing 15, 18-year funding, the challenge is, who are the banks that are going to step in to do that? Domestic banks cannot provide that kind of tenor. And if you look at commercial banks, we know who they are. They're one, two, maybe three that can provide tenors. But the commercial banking market, unless they've got ironclad guarantees, ECA-backed type structures, they're not there. So that leaves then DFIs and the MDBs and people like ourselves. So as much as I'd love to say we'll be exiting soon, sadly not the case. And if you look at our debt fund, and recently I was going back through some of the reasoning and papers and logic for setting it up 19 years ago. And it's unfortunate because you read those reasons for setting it up 19 years ago, they're just as valid today. So there's still work to do. But at least I can say, it's a joy, I must say, that on the guarantee side, we have the ability to transform the market and effectively provide the capacity building and the development of local capital markets to substitute ourselves and put ourselves out of business there.
Thanks so much for speaking to us today. Really illuminating conversation and also great to hear that you take a positive outlook where possible. If people would like to hear more from you, you're going to be joining us at the Africa Debate on the 5th of November.
I will, yes. Look forward to it.
Yeah. where we'll be speaking a bit more and a bit more detail about some of these issues. So if you'd like to meet Philippe or the pitch team, please do join the debate in November. If you want to learn more about Pidge and the work that Pidge does, you can also find out more at www.pidge.org. Philippe, thank you. Thanks once again for speaking to us.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.